class. And if you're unfamiliar, Paradox Sunday School class is the Sunday School class here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church that Hugh Ross teaches every Sunday that he is in town, which is about three Sundays out of four, in room 154. And we always have treats at Paradox class. That's what makes it the best class at church here, besides Hugh's teaching, of course. So have fun over there. Lots of good food. I think that's all the announcements I have. I want to introduce to you Dr. Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia, a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He is the founder and president of Reasons to Believe, which is an organization which tries to integrate the words of scripture with the words of nature. Does an amazing job. I know in my own life, he really saved my faith in a lot of ways. I had a lot of questions that Christians couldn't answer. I believed in science. I believed in the power of science. I also believed the Bible, and I could not put them together. And when I was able to do that, when I was able to integrate them and see that the same God wrote the Bible who wrote the record of nature, I was more confident in my faith, and it made it a lot easier for me to talk about my faith. So whether you're a believer or not, it's an amazingly powerful message, and you're going to get a taste of that this morning. So if you have a question, you ought to start lining up. Dr. Ross is going to start with a latest scientific discovery, and he will stop talking as soon as somebody gets to the mic and starts to ask a question. Have I missed anything?
No, that will do it. And yes, I'll stop talking the moment someone comes to the microphone. I can always talk about the latest scientific discoveries.
Forever.
Hey, if you want, yeah, literally forever. And one way we demonstrate that, if you go to my Twitter site, I give you short tweets that alert you to the latest scientific research papers that give more evidence for the Christian faith. And I'm posting an average of about four per day. If I had time, I could post 10 per day. But if you've never been to that Twitter site, I encourage you to go. I always give you a direct link to the research paper so you can see for yourself. You say, hey, I'm not really into reading those scientific papers. The abstracts are always fairly easy to read, and the abstracts are always made available free of charge to the entire public. So do take advantage of that. But I don't see anyone behind the microphone yet, so I got a question for you. How many of you have ever had a bad hair day? Okay. Last time I had a bad hair day when I was about 19, so I don't have bad hair days. But you know, stars have bad flare days. In fact, a recent research discovery was on the star nearest to our star, the Sun, Proxima Centauri. You've probably heard of it. It's just a little bit more than 4 light years away. In fact, they actually have plans to send a spacecraft to visit the tiny planet that's orbiting Proxima Centauri. And Proxima Centauri is an M-type star. I won't go into the details, but M-type stars make up about 75 to 80% of all the stars in our Milky Way galaxy. They're the most common kind of star. And because this star is so nearby, a research team was able to do a detailed study of its flaring activity. And it's such that it has 8 super flares per year and has an average of 63 flares per day. Okay, our sun doesn't flare much. And we haven't had a super flare, in over 150 years. And by the way, if we ever were to get one today, it would knock out all the GPS, probably knock out most of the satellites. When last time we had a super flare, it knocked out all the telegraph communication. So you can imagine what it would do today. And hey, my son's comment is, if that were to happen, it would be the end of civilization as we know it. So be put back into the pre-internet age. But we're now recognizing that this is kind of the norm for stars, and our star is the exception. And you'll actually see a blog article I wrote in our reasons.org website on the flaring activity of our star, the Sun. And how when it was younger, It was flaring much more frequently than it is today by up to a factor of a million times. And as the sun gets older, it's going to start aggressive flaring again, and literally up to a factor of a million times more than where it is today. So we're living at the one moment in the sun's history where it's got minimum flaring. Matter of fact, we're living at the one moment in the sun's history where it's got the kind of stable luminosity that makes civilization possible. So the sun can burn for 9 billion years, but only 40 to 50,000 years ago did it enter into this sufficiently stable luminosity phase where the flaring activity was very low. And when's that going to end? In another 40 to 50,000 years. So if you want to know why God created Adam and Eve 40 to 50 to 60 to 70,000 years ago, that's why. Because he wanted us human beings to be able to launch and sustain global civilization, and it required a very special kind of star, and the star had to be at a very precise age. I still don't see anybody behind the microphone. Oh, now we got someone.
We have one person. I'm kind of monitoring the mic, but I actually have a question, so someone to start since I was in line first here. We do have space back here, so if you have a question, please come over and sit on the chairs in there. Hugh, your book, Improbable Planet, has been out for a little while now, and I was curious what type of reviews you're getting from two sources, both the Christian community and also from the secular science community, if you've gotten any feedback now that those people have had a chance to read it and analyze it and think about it.
Well, I've actually had people communicate with me and tell me they read the book and it brought them to faith in Jesus Christ. And that's really the goal of every book that we write, that would happen. But this is the fastest we've seen it happen because the book's only been out for about a month. If you want to see what people think about, a good place to go is Amazon.com and read the reviews. And we've had reviews from a wide spectrum of people, believers as well as unbelievers. The reviews have been incredibly positive and very inspiring. I've had one negative review. The negative reviewer still gave it 3 stars, but he read through the book and said it's filled with phenomenal new evidences for fine-tuning design to make human beings possible. But I got 2/3 of the way through the book and discovered that the author actually believes that the Earth is older than 10,000 years. So he said, since I believe the Bible teaches that it's less than 10,000 years, I'm only going to give it 3 stars. So that's the only negative or semi-negative review I've gotten so far. I was rather surprised that it took him reading 2/3 of the way through the book for him to figure out. Because, I mean, the very first chapter talks about what God has to do with the universe to make a planet like Earth possible. And to make a planet like Earth possible, you need 9 billion years of uranium and thorium manufacture. One of the reasons why advanced life is possible here on planet Earth, we live on the most uranium thorium rich rocky body in the entire universe. And it's because of the enormous amount of uranium and thorium that we have on the surface of our planet, both continents and oceans. It's the uranium and the thorium that make the continents, at least a major factor in making those continents possible. Say, how anomalous are we? Well, compared to other rocky bodies, we have 340 times as much uranium, and we have 640 times as much thorium. In fact, thorium may be the solution to the energy crisis humans are facing, because we now have the technology to build thorium reactors. And they're much cleaner than uranium reactors, much more energy productive, and we have a whole lot more thorium than we have uranium. So that could be the energy source of the future. We'll see. All thanks to the Earth being exactly the right age.
Morning, Dr. Ross and Ross. if you'll just bear with me for a minute or two here, and then I have my question. This is such a wonderful forum, and I'm just inclined and led by the Spirit, I think, to just really encourage everyone to invite people here. My idea, since I go out and preach, is to go in front of the high schools and hand out flyers as they come out of class. It'd just be so nice to have this place filled. I mean, we're so blessed to have Dr. Ross and Reasons to Believe, and particularly to have Dr. Ross here in the San Gabriel Valley. So I just wanted to say that. and I'd encourage everybody to copy the flyers when they come out, when we have skeptics forums, and distribute them, you know, not just throw them on cars or anything, but hand them to people that seem to be interested. Okay, my question, I can try to speak up for the recording here, is I've been told that the hardest question you ever answered was like where to find parking when it's really busy here. But seriously, have you ever been stumped? I've never seen you once been stumped at a skeptics forum when people have asked a question about the Bible or science. So if you don't mind me asking that question, I'd just like to ask you that.
Oh yeah, I've been stumped many times, and the most common stump is where somebody comes to the microphone and says, Dr. Ross, can you comment on this research paper that got published a few hours ago? And I say, well, I haven't seen it. After I've read it, I'll be happy to comment on it. And sometimes it's 48 hours ago, but yeah, we make it a point at Reasons to Believe to try to keep up with the latest scientific literature, but there's literally thousands of science research journals out there. We don't have the time to read them all. So yeah, quite frequently I get questions about articles that haven't had a time to peruse. But you know, it's always okay to tell people, you know, I'll get back to you. So if anybody stumps you, that's the right answer. How about if I get back to you? And that's where we at Reasons to Believe are here to back you up. So if you get stumped, feel free to call us and we'll find some way to get the answer to the question that you're being dealt with. But yeah, one question that always stumps me is, Hugh, where did you leave your car? My wife's comment is, I know every star in the sky, but I can't remember where I parked the car. So. Got a question back there.
Hi. First, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Terry Lujan, and I'm here as an invited guest of Mark and Valerie Durham. This is my second opportunity to actually hear us speak. I don't often have the opportunity or time, so I'm very happy to be here. I came with a couple of questions, but I think I'm going to change it. Just recently, I met a person who I've invited to come who believes, she's Gnostic, and believes that our bodies are hell. That our bodies are hell. And has a very sort of negative perspective of energy and the world. So I kind of would like to pursue maybe information that goes, well, really, what is the belief in hell? What is, does hell exist? And the paranormal kind of issues that come up with that about demons, portals, angels, and those existence.
Okay, good. You're referring to Gnostic. And the typical Gnostic belief is that the physical world is illusory. So our bodies are illusions. But there's a subset that says that the physical realm is evil. And so only the spirit realm is good, the physical realm is evil. So those are the two different sects of Gnosticism. And you know, one way to deal with the illusory people, and this comes from Walter Martin, who dealt with Gnostic cults, he says, just punch them in the nose.
And, I kind of want to run away.
If they scream out in pain, then you've proven the point that the physical world is not an illusion. So, but let me give you a less pugnacious way to deal with it. The very fact that we astronomers can use trigonometric methods to pinpoint the positions of stars and galaxies tells us they must be real objects. So, and if you don't recall, remember your high school geometry classes where they took you through Greek geometry? If you know the length of the base of the triangle, you know the angles of both sides of an isosceles triangle, you can determine the distance to the object that's at the vertex. And that's how we astronomers measure distances in the universe. That's the foundation for all of our distant measurements. We call that direct distance measurement. It only works if objects are real. So the very fact that we can do that, and now we can do it out to a half billion light years. So thanks to our capacity to link radio telescopes all over the world, we can get the kind of measurements of these angles that are good to six places of the decimal. And that's enabling us to use this method literally out to a half billion light years. So way beyond the Virgo supercluster, we can measure the distances of a galaxies. Now, this person was saying that our bodies are hell.
Correct.
I imagine they're extending that everything physical is hell.
Is hell.
Well, that contradicts a clear teaching of the Bible, where the Bible speaks about a time when God will remove the physical universe from existence. So all matter, energy, space, and time, God spoke it into existence. There will come a time when he speaks it out of existence. And what we notice is that heaven and hell survive God removing the physical realm, which means that hell is not part of the physical realm. So in that case, it would be a mistake to identify our bodies as hell, because the Bible makes it clear that hell is not part of our physical realm. Now, the Gnostic might come back and say, well, who says I have to believe the Bible? Well, what's interesting is that the two Gnostic cults I mentioned, they do believe the Bible. They misinterpret mm-hmm. the Bible.
Yes.
And so they would recognize the Bible as authority. But for people who think that we're in some kind of a matrix and, you know, we've eaten, blue pill instead of the red pill? I forget the story. You can probably help me on this since you're a movie buff and I'm not. So, but the whole point there is that, I forgot where I was going. Where was I going on this?
You were talking about the
existence of hell.
Existence of hell in the spiritual world. And hell being real because...
Oh, yeah. How do you establish the Bible's authority to
right.
someone that doesn't accept the Bible as being the authoritative word of God? And this is, I think, the best way to do that is to show people its predictive power, its capacity to predict future historical events, like the resurrection, like the end times prophecy that you see in Ezekiel about the modern nation Israel, that can be effective. Or for people who are into the science, show how the Bible has predicted future scientific discoveries. I found one of the most effective tools. You'll see a free article on our website. It's called Big Bang, The Bible Taught It First, making the point that thousands of years ago, the Bible accurately predicted all the fundamental features of what we call Big Bang cosmology. And the astronomers never came up with this until the 20th century. So this is one way to dramatically demonstrate that the Bible was accurately predicting future scientific discoveries thousands of years ahead of its time, and has never been wrong in predicting future scientific discoveries, and has done it over 200 places. So that's one way out of many ways you can show the skeptic that the Bible has credibility. And where else are you going to get any kind of credible information about hell anyway? So it really is our only source of getting some information about the nature of hell. But the bottom line is, it's not subject to the laws of physics or the space-time dimensions of the universe.
Well, thank you. You offered a very good explanation. I'm really hoping that she will take advantage and come tomorrow night.
All right, that'd be great.
I'm sure she'll have some good questions for you, too. Thank you.
I think, though, as some of us get older, our bodies really are hell.
Well, Romans 8 tells us that the entire creation is subject to a pervasive law of decay. And if you don't believe that, look around you.
Mel?
In the Bible, in Joshua, it talks about the earth standing still. I think it was for one day in order
right.
for a battle to be won. Are we to take that literally? And if so, is there any scientific evidence for that?
We are to take it literally. However, it's in Hebrew, not English. And this is one of the more challenging texts of the Bible to translate into English. And the thing we need to appreciate here is that we're translating from a very tiny vocabulary language into the largest vocabulary language that's ever existed. I mean, the English language, the vocabulary size now exceeds 4 million words. Biblical Hebrew, if you don't count the names of towns and people, 3,000 words. So virtually every Hebrew noun and Hebrew verb has multiple literal definitions. and you have to carefully look at the context to see which definition you go to. And this also applies to what you see about the Christmas star in the New Testament, because you can easily read the English translation and get the idea that the star stopped and shone a searchlight right down to where Jesus was. And that's not what the text is saying. The Greek word histeme has got 30 different definitions. So you need to look at the context to see which one you use. Well, with respect to Joshua's long day, what you discover is that when you read it in the Hebrew, it's either Joshua appealing to God for an extended period of daylight or an extended period of darkness. And Hebrew scholars that I've talked to said the most likely interpretation is that it's an extended period of darkness, not an extended period of light. And I visited the Valley of Jilin with my wife back in 1980. It's a small valley in the Negev Desert, ringed by hills. It's really hot there, like 115 to 120 degrees, and very, very dry. And it could be, and this is what my Hebrew scholar friends tell me, that one reason why it's much more likely to translate at, as an extended period of darkness is that Joshua would need some way to keep things cool enough that his troops could continue to fight the battle. And an extra period of daylight would actually stop the battle in its tracks because of the extreme heat that they would be experiencing. And it's a place where there's really no water. And so it's not like they could get water easily to maintain the battle. Now, when it talks about the sun and the moon standing still, that's the English translation. Basically what the text is communicating is that this was an extended period of darkness or an extended period of light. And the darkness lasted for 24 hours, or the light lasted for 24 hours. And I say 24 hours, about 24 hours. I say that because there's been people looking at the positions of the sun, moon, and stars and trying to calculate to an exact precision 24 hours of discrepancy and different movements. And it's like, it's about 24 hours. So it wouldn't bother me if it turns out to be 23 or 25. And roughly an extra few hours of darkness would be all that Joshua would need to complete the task at hand. There's nothing in the text that says that there was a stoppage in the movement of any of the celestial bodies that make up our solar system. Nothing in the text that says that God stopped the rotation rate of the earth or stopped the moon in the sky, and if that were to happen, all humanity would have been driven to instant extermination. And the text tells us that people apparently didn't even notice anything like that going on. So there was no disturbance in the capacity of Joshua's soldiers to fight the battle. So I think what we need to understand it is a miracle that God performed to impose an extended period of darkness, or less likely, an extended period of light. And given this tiny size of the valley, that could be a dramatic meteorological event. And it never happens here in Southern California, but where I grew up in coastal British Columbia, we would get storms where it would be so dark you couldn't read. I mean, it felt like darkness, and it'd be in the middle of the day. And some of you in the Midwest have experienced storms of that nature where it gets so dark in the middle of the day you need a flashlight to guide your way around. So that could be what's happening. And to me, the more outstanding miracle recorded in the Bible is the one of Hezekiah's sundial recorded in Isaiah, where it speaks about the sundial going back 40 minutes of time, the shadow on the sundial going back 40 minutes of time. What makes that a little more dramatic is the text tells us that the miracle was also seen in Babylon. So it's seen in both Jerusalem and Babylon, where the shadow went backwards 40 minutes. And so what would it take to move the shadow backwards 40 minutes? And it was such an outstanding event that the priests of Marduk, the god of Babylon was Marduk. And when they saw what happened, they said, we need to send a delegation to Jerusalem, because this isn't our God. This has got to be the real God the one that the Jews worship in Jerusalem. So they actually sent a delegation, and when they arrived there, the priest said, yeah, we saw it here too. Now that's 600 miles apart. We're no longer talking a small valley ringed by hills. We're talking a geographical extent of 600 miles as a crow flies. And so Bible interpreters have said, probably the easiest way to understand that miracle is God shining his Shekinah glory at a particular angle in both Jerusalem and Babylon. But there's other ways we could explain the miracle as well. So, but as far as Joshua's long day, an outstanding meteorological, unprecedented meteorological event could explain what was happening at that time. Similar to what happened to Deborah when she was up on top of Mount Tabor. And what does the text tell us? It was dry on top of Mount Tabor, but there was torrential rainstorm at the bottom of Mount Tabor. Tabor stands 2,000 feet above the Jezreel Plain. That's not how meteorology works. You always get way more rain at high elevations than you do low elevations. This is an instance where it's the exact reverse. And that was responsible for Deborah and the Israelite army winning the victory. But good question.
Hi. I'm interested in knowing if lung cancer is being caused by radon gas through the use of natural gas for cooking and heating and whatever.
Could lung cancer be caused by radon gas? Yeah, it definitely can. Any kind of radiation can bring about cancer. And probably the biggest source of radon gas in our culture would be granite countertops in your kitchen. I don't want you to get alarmed because we have granite in our kitchen. Okay, it's the kind of granite. But if you're worried, you get one of these radon testing devices and see whether or not you got radon at a dangerous level in your kitchen. Some granites are bad news. And one thing I can tell you is the most likely culprit is a red granite. But not all red granites are a radon problem. Only a few special radon granites are a problem. Now, living in California, we also are living in a high uranium environment. So any vegetables growing in California will have a high uranium content. Now, when I say high, it's not enough to guarantee you're going to get cancer by the time you're age 100. You could be living in California. In fact, what I've learned is that if you live in California, your uranium exposure will shorten your lifespan by about 3 weeks. If you live in Colorado, the higher altitude will shorten your lifespan by 3 months. So in that sense, you're better off living at sea level in California than living at a high elevation. There's lots of things that work to shorten your lifespan, but radiation is one thing that will do it, and it's not just radon. That's the first time I've ever gotten a question on radon, by the way.
Oh, good morning. I had a question. I asked you, this is a follow-up on something I asked about a year ago. I guess I'm kind of slow and need your help again on this, but I've been doing some reading lately on the development of life on this planet from the simple to the complex, and as I understand it, and you can, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, reasons to believe, and you believe it, that God needed to specially intervene to create new species, as we've seen this development of from the simple to the complex. And another perspective would say that God didn't need to intervene in order to see that development. The question I have would some people see that as kind of a God of the gaps argument, that that we need God to step in to fill in something that we can't understand how it might have happened? And if it's a, and Chris, I don't think any of us are very attracted to a God of the gaps kind of idea, because it's as the gaps fill in, then God gets smaller. But, and of course, God is not just the God of our lack of understanding, but a God of what we understand as well. So he's sovereign over everything and not just gaps. So is that a criticism of RTB? And part two of this question, I guess, is, can you suggest something where our knowledge increases a gap in that specific area that we're...
Well, the question you're asking is a major theme of a Two View books that were just finished. We're coming up with a Two Views book where it's basically reasons to believe, debating biologos and their evolutionary creationism model. And so, you know, their basic belief is that, you know, God, in a very indirect way, controls the evolution of life from the first life form up through human beings. Whereas our model is that God is directly involved in a way that is scientifically discoverable. And, you know, to be fair to them, they would say, we think God is directly involved too, but in a way that can't be scientifically discovered. So it's very subtle what God does. Now, what you'll see, the book will be out in about maybe a year and a half. It's finished, but we're bringing it out through InterVarsity Press, and they take a long time to bring books out, so it'll be about a year and a half. But the book writing is now complete. But a core part of that debate is looking at God of the gaps as a charge against reasons to believe, and then we're talking about nature of the gaps. Because whenever people say, hey, you're committing God of the gaps, well, wait a minute, there are gaps with all models. What happens to the gaps as we learn more? And so what I'm bringing up in my contribution is something called the physics of the sun. And the sun gets brighter and brighter throughout the history of life on planet Earth as it converts hydrogen to helium in its core. But life can only tolerate about a 2% change in the sun's brightness. And so we're arguing that God, knowing the future physics of the sun, removes life from planet Earth on a periodic basis and replaces it with new life, where that new life is more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun's getting brighter and brighter, the Earth's atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient in its capacity to trap heat, and therefore keeps the temperature in the surface of the Earth at an optimal level so that life can be abundant and continuous on the face of the Earth. You know, and I'm pointing out in my couple of chapters that if you have the wrong life there, or if you have the right life at the wrong time, it has the consequence of making the planet permanently sterile. So the only way to really explain 3.8 billion years of continuous abundant life on planet Earth is there must be a mind that's directly involved in controlling exactly which life is there on planet Earth and which life is not. And this has got to be done at least on a frequency basis of about once every 30 million years. If it isn't, then you run into trouble. And what's interesting about the orbit of planet Earth, or probably the orbit of the solar system, about the center of our galaxy, is it stays right in the plane. Of all the stars we observe, ours is unique, and it stays in the plane, but it still goes up and down a little bit as it orbits around the sun, and the up and down movement has a periodicity of about 30 million years. And therefore, the new analysis is that that actually allows for extraterrestrial mass extinction events, and given the fine tuning of Earth's plate tectonics, it's enough to wipe out a sufficient fraction of Earth's life that we can have a mass speciation event thereafter to replace the life that's been removed. And we also point out that you actually see this in Psalm 104. Verses 29 and 30. It's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And evidently, he does it quite frequently. But hey, year and a half, you'll be able to read both sides of the debate and see whether or not it's the which gaps are getting smaller and which gaps are getting bigger.
Hugh, I got a response to the question that too. I was a product of public education, and so was taught evolution and believed it to be 100% true. And I have to say, obviously, that at that time, that my professors were honest enough to say that there was gaps, that the fossil rocket's not complete. We really can't prove that evolution is true. That's why we call it a theory. But he said they all guaranteed that you just give us another 10, 20, 30 years, we'll dig up more bones, we'll do more experiments on species, and we can prove evolution is true. I no longer believe in evolution, not because of the Bible, because there is no scientific evidence to support it. We've dug up more fossil records, and we find out we don't have a tree, we have a bush. and you can't connect species. Matter of fact, species even get shuffled from one branch to another, you know, and it's a bush. And then they said, well, natural selection selects things. Well, we know now that natural selection has limits. You can only push a species so far, and it doesn't want to move any further. Then they said, well, mutations is the reason we have all this diversity. So we do tests on mutations, and we find out that mutations drive species extinct. They don't create eyes, they don't create lungs, they don't create hearts. And so I've given up on evolution just because I've waited 40 years for the scientific community to give me that evidence that they promised me, that it's proved that it's true, and it's the opposite. It's one of the few scientific researches, origin of life and speciation of evolution, where there's less evidence every year. There's not more. I ask, give me the evidence, and every year there's less evidence. Am I wrong?
Well, I got with me here in my folder 5 papers published just in the last 2 weeks, basically talking about the Avalon and Cameron explosions of life. And there's a lot of debate. You know, maybe there is a considerable passage of time between the Avalon extinction and the Cambrian mass speciation event, or maybe the Avalon wasn't as catastrophic. There's also debates as to how much time transpired between the end of the Gaskier's glaciation event and the beginning of the Avalon explosion, or the end of the Avalon animals and what's called the Great Unconformity, which is a chemical turnover in the oceans of the Earth. 5 papers have been published that basically are giving us much better data than we've had before. And that new data, I won't go into the details, but the new data basically is making things far more difficult for the evolutionary biologists and the paleontologists in trying to support a naturalistic interpretation. Because what we notice is that, yes, the Avalon extinction event was complete, and very quickly thereafter, if we're talking less than 1 million years, we got these Cambrian animals and of all different kinds. And I think what's encouraging, too, there's a book out by James Valentine about the Cambrian explosion. And he's a staunch evolutionist, thoroughly believes that we can get new genera and new orders through naturalistic evolution. But what he writes in this book on the Cambrian explosion is there's no way you're going to get new phyla, is that that seems to be a showstopper for all evolutionary models. As you can't explain where a new body plan comes from. And he says, what we see with both the Avalon and the Cambrian explosions are dozens of simultaneous body plans appearing out of nowhere. And we say out of nowhere, you go from microbes to animals that are 2 meters across with no measurable time separation between nothing bigger than a microbe and suddenly these giant animals that show up in the face of the Earth. And it coincides precisely with a sudden burst of oxygen in the atmosphere going from 1% to 8%. That's the Avalon animals. The Cambrian animals, they show up as soon as the oxygen hits 10%, because you need 10% oxygen to have eyes and internal organs and digestive tracts. So anyway, that's all new stuff on the Cambrian explosion. You can read a lot about this in Improbable Planet. There's a chapter there on the Cambrian and Avalon explosions. But I find interesting, thanks to what's happened in the last 2 weeks, we have a much stronger case for a model today than what you'll see published in the book.
Hey, so I wanted to ask a question about, I think it was either in Navigating Genesis or Who Is Adam? There was a, he gave a model for the long lifespans in Genesis 5 and 11. I don't know which book it was that
right, didn't Navigating Genesis.
Navigating Genesis, okay. That didn't have to be supernatural. I'm cool with it being supernatural. Either way, it doesn't matter to me. But I was wondering for like, before I ask a question, do you know about the Genesis 5, the hidden treasure of the names?
Well, yeah, I'm aware of the genealogy in Genesis 5.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the breakdown of what each name means, and it's a prophetic, the prophecy in it. You know, man appointed mortal, Saul, the blessed God shall come down.
Yeah, I'm aware of that interpretation.
Interpretation, okay.
Okay.
So if that's a possibility, if that's a possibility of like, you know, of that genealogy being there for the case of prophecy, right? If that holds true, right, then does that mean that we haven't just yet found out what the long lifespans mean? And if, is that something that, that could be discovered? And secondly, if that's the case, does that interfere with in chapter 6 when it talks about men will be mortal, they won't live past 120 years old?
Right. Yes, what you see in Genesis 6:3 is that God steps in post, you know, with the flood event and says lifespans will now be a maximum of 120 years. Now, again, I think that's to two places of the decimal. If somebody makes it to 121, that doesn't contradict what the text says. It's 120 plus or minus 5. And often, I mention that because often atheists criticize the Bible for its numerical inaccuracies, and they fail to recognize that the Bible, like other works of literature, rounds off. But Paul says 540 years, and Stephen says 400 years. They're both talking about the same event. One's giving it to you to two places the decimal, one to just one place the decimal. So 120 years, that's the maximum, and that proves to be the case. I mean, if you look at records where people have got a legitimate birth certificate, you don't get people living more than a year or two past 120 years. That is a fundamental limitation. And it's a fundamental limitation because of the radiation environment in which we live. I mean, we're exposed to igneous rocks, we're exposed to cosmic and solar radiation, and that radiation by itself guarantees that you won't make it past 120 years. A secondary reason why you're not gonna make it past 120 years is your chromosomes get shorter as you get older and older. So my chromosomes today are a lot shorter than they were when I was a teenager. And that's actually a good thing. The shortening of your chromosomes with respect to time is one way our bodies prevent cancers from bringing us an earlier death. If our chromosomes were not getting shorter, we'd be at a far greater risk of tumors getting out of control and killing us when we're 20 and 30. Thanks to the shortening of our chromosomes, we can make it 70, 80, 90 years. Okay, take away the radiation exposure. You wouldn't have to have the telomerase activity or the chromosome shortening as aggressive as what it is. And so what we argue in Navigating Genesis is we now have scientific evidence that indeed people living in the days before the flood were not exposed to the radiation we human beings are today. What is that evidence? Well, there's two sources of evidence. One is there's a couple of astronomers, Wolfendale, a British astronomer, and Ehrlichan, a Russian astronomer, that have been partnering for, over 40 years now, trying to determine the cosmic ray, the source of the cosmic ray exposure. Now, cosmic rays come from supernova remnants scattered all over our galaxy. Most cosmic rays are electrons and protons, and they don't really do your body that much damage. The ones that really damage your body are what are called fast-moving heavy nuclei cosmic rays. What do I mean? Like, say, an oxygen nucleus moving it close to the velocity of light. When that goes through your body, it can do some significant damage. A uranium nucleus moving it close to the velocity of light can do a whole lot of damage. And what these two astronomers have discovered is that 95% of these heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays come from a single supernova eruption. And they've been on a quest for 40 years to find that supernova. And for about 30 of those 40 years, they thought, well, the best candidate is the Vela supernova. We know it exploded recently and relatively close. That's got to be the culprit. But the last decade of their research, they said, we now know that Vela's not close enough to be the culprit. It's the closest easy to see supernova remnant that we see in the sky. They're now fingering a much more difficult to see supernova remnant called a Monoceros ring. It's 25 degrees across in the sky. And because it's so huge, the remnant is so dispersed, it's extremely difficult to detect. But it has been detected, and being that size across the sky, it means that it's the remnant of a supernova that exploded close to the Earth and within the last 100,000 years. And Oerlikon and Wolfendale are now working to try to get a better date than sometime between 0 and 100,000 years ago. So yeah, the error bar is plus or minus 50,000 years. And what I argue in Navigating Genesis, this is much more likely to be the culprit than the Vela supernova. And moreover, we have data from that that tells us it's more recent, probably more recent than the Vela supernova, and so could easily be coincident with the timing of Noah's flood. If it's coincident with the timing of Noah's flood, that would mean that people before Noah's flood were not exposed to those killer cosmic rays, whereas everybody after Noah's flood was exposed. And when you look at Genesis chapter 11, you see an exponential decline in human lifespans recorded in the patriarchs there that go from Noah to Abraham, which would be consistent with a radiation explanation for the shortening of human lifespans. And you know, you heard the comment, well, that could all just be natural phenomena happening with coincidental timing. What's not coincidental is that someone stepped in and gave us greater telomerase activity than we had before. And that would require a supernatural mind, the God of the Bible, intervening at the time of Noah to make sure that our chromosomes shortened a lot more rapidly than they did in the days before Noah. But if you read Navigating Genesis, here's what to me is a chilling account of what's going on in those early chapters of Genesis. We human beings today have a higher average lifespan than people did in the days before the flood. What you see recorded in Genesis 5 are the very few individuals that weren't murdered by their fellow man, and therefore they died of natural causes, which means they lived to 800 or 900 years. The vast majority of humanity was having their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. And we actually calculate, based on a number of certain lacks of evidence, that the probably at least 19 out of 20 human beings living the days before the flood were having their lives terminated by murder, which gives you an idea why God had to intervene the way he did. The intervention with the flood actually saved humanity from self-extermination. And also you can understand that who's getting murdered more frequently? Well, when you have a murder rate that high, it works in favor of the wicked and against the righteous. It's not the righteous that are going to be killing off their fellow man, it's going to be the wicked. And therefore what happens is the human population rapidly evolves to being mostly righteous to being almost entirely wicked. Such at the time of Noah, there was only one family left that was not engaged in that kind of wicked behavior. And so the flood actually saved humanity from self-extermination. But yeah, look around you. We today are living longer than any other generation of humanity, even longer than people in the days before the flood. And actually look at what's being taught in Genesis. What's being taught there isn't a lesson we all need to learn. It's not good to live long on the face of the earth. If you follow a righteous lifestyle, if you give your life to Jesus Christ, your future is a lot better than your present. And so it's good to leave this planet and graduate to a much better place. But likewise, even for the wicked, it's good that they don't live a long time. And so come Thanksgiving Day, you might want to thank God for the fact that you only live 80 or 90 years instead of 800 or 900 years. It's a blessing.
One thing too, you based on what you just said, it means that God triggered, in whatever way he did, he triggered the supernova before the circumstances that happened that required it.
Yeah, that supernova exploded long before the radiation reached here on planet Earth. So it's something that probably happened long before Noah and his compatriots had any idea what was going on.
So we're going to take one more question, and then we're going to do the drawing. So if you could get those cards filled out, and Diana, if you want to start collecting those, that would be great. We'll take one more question, and we'll do the drawing. So go ahead.
This is great. I'm hoping we can do this once a month instead of once every 3 months. It's a great evangelistic tool, I think. But anyway, I had a question about degrees of suffering in hell, but I'm going to let that be asked later, because your last answer was so intriguing to me. This is like a two-part thing in relation to your response. First of all, I've heard that the sufferings or the reason God judged man because of the flood was because he intermingled with the Nephilim. But the actual text of the Bible says that man's heart and mind was on evil continually during that time. So it's probably a combination of both of those things, right? That's my first question. And then my second question related to your answer is these supernovas that gave us these heavier elements. It's puzzling to me how the explosion of a star, which is energy, would deposit matter onto the Earth in different areas, like we find uranium deep within the Earth and stuff. It's just kind of puzzling to me how God did that. And maybe that's a question I just have to ask God when I die. You know, how did you do that?
Well, but that question is actually answered in Improbable Planet.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
I think it's in chapter 4 that you'll find the answer.
I'll read the book. But and, maybe you can answer about the Genesis 6 question.
I'll give you the Genesis 6 stuff, too. But
thank you.
You know, where the supernova bless our planet with all these heavy elements is when the solar system is so young that the Earth is still in the process of forming. And our solar system actually was born in a really dense cluster of stars. More than 10,000 stars were in the same cluster in which our sun was born. And as a result, it found itself being bathed with the radiation from supernova eruptions. Because when you're in a really dense star cluster like that, the big stars burn up really quickly. And when they end their burning cycle, they explode as supernova. And so the sun being a smaller star, while the planets are barely yet forming, it would have been bathed in the radiation from these exploding supernova. And what's interesting is that different kinds of supernova make different kinds of elements heavier than iron. And one of the unique things, this is mentioned in the book about planet Earth, when we were born, we had 94 elements. Today we have 92. Because Neptunian and plutonium have completely decayed away. But we have 92 elements because we're born in a cluster where four different kinds of supernova exploded in the near vicinity of the sun, bathing our sun with these heavy elements that got incorporated into the condensing planet Earth. And so that explains where we got all these heavy elements. Actually, the story is more complicated than that. I won't go into that. But it's one of the arguments for the exquisite design that made possible life. And the good news, too, is we didn't stay in that star cluster. If we had stayed in that star cluster, the emerging system of planets would have been gravitationally beat up by adjoining stars. Fortunately, once we got enriched with all those heavy elements, our star got kicked out of the birth cluster and deposited into the safest part of our galaxy. There's only one location in our galaxy where advanced life can be sustained. So we were born in one of the most dangerous parts of our galaxy and deposited into the safest part, but only after we got enriched with everything that we need. Now, responding to Genesis 6 and the Nephilim, and maybe you can remind me of his question again.
Yeah, it had to do with the Nephilim.
Did God judge the land, the earth, solely because of the sins of man, you know, or was it also because of the interbreeding of women with the men of renown, the Nephilim?
Okay, what you'll see in Genesis 6 is not either or, it's both. When it refers to the wickedness of humans, basically it was saying everybody except for Noah and his family, every inclination in their mind was how can I perpetrate physical harm on my fellow human beings. Literally, every thought in their head was focused on doing physical damage, either injuring or killing their fellow human beings. And it uses two Hebrew words to describe the wickedness of that generation, words that are used nowhere else in the Old Testament. So never before in the history of our planet have we had humanity degraded to that degree of wickedness and evil, where literally every thought in their head was evil. In other words, they were incapable of having a single good thought in their head. Every thought was evil, and every inclination was, how can I do physical damage to my fellow human beings? And there was a question earlier, what about the suffering that people experience in hell? Well, keep in mind, the inhabitants of hell are going to be just like that. Every inclination is going to be one of, how can I do physical damage? And what we see in Revelation 20 is that the inhabitants of hell receive torment, and the torment will be in proportion to the evil they've committed here on earth, basically making the point that some individuals need more torment to prevent them from wrecking harm upon their fellow inhabitants, because that's going to be the inclination. How can I do physical damage? How can I do harm to my fellow inhabitants? And the torment of hell restrains individuals from making hell a worse place than otherwise would be. So what I tell people that are committed in their rebellion against Jesus Christ, it's still a good idea to try to live as virtuous a life as possible, because it means you get less torment when you go to hell. And that's a better situation than getting more torment. So some need more than others will need. There's a flip side to that. There's every advantage to people who are followers of Jesus Christ to do everything they can to please the Lord, because there's different levels of reward in the kingdom of heaven. And so what Paul says, run the race of life with all the energy you got, because there's a prize there at the finish line, and go for the biggest prize you can possibly go for.
Hugh, I want to point out the really amazing thing on this, on both that story of the flood and the wickedness, is science has always been wondered and baffled that, considering humanity has been on the planet for so long, why the population stayed so low. We have just very little information, obviously, of why the population was so low and then finally went up. And the second one, the amazing one, is no matter what culture you go to around the world, they all have some flood story. It doesn't always match the biblical narrative, you know, but it's oral changes probably over time. But they all have a story of an ancient flood, not a current flood, but an ancient flood, which I find is just fascinating, that both the Bible explains why the population was so low for so long and why all these cultures have the story of a flood.
Well, if you look in the different cultures of the world, there's 100 different creation stories, but there's over 150 different flood stories. So the story of the flood is more ubiquitous in human cultures than the creation story. And that's one of the reasons why sociologists believe the flood event has to be true, because it's pervasive in all cultures. And also you notice the degree of distortion of the flood story depends on how far away you are from the Persian Gulf area and how far back in time you would be. But Improbable Planet actually answers the question, why did the human population remain so low for such a long period of time? Well, we know from Genesis 2 that Adam and Eve were created during the last ice age. Why? Because it speaks about four rivers that we all know what the rivers are, where they come from, as mentioned in the text. It says they come together in the Garden of Eden. Well, the only place they come together today is 300 feet under sea level. During the last ice age, it was dry land, because during the last ice age, the sea level was 330 feet lower than it is today. So Adam and Eve were created during the last ice age. But during the last ice age, the temperature, global mean temperature, was jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit. That made it impossible for early humanity to engage in large-scale specialized agriculture. We now know, and you'll see some citations in the book, that early humans indeed were engaged in agriculture. They were roasting, they were gathering grains, roasting grains, and baking flour, making pastry products. But it was all very low scale, because of the fact they were having to survive in a climate regime where the temperature is jumping up and down by 24 degrees. Not until the climate stabilized do you see large-scale agriculture being engaged. And that's what made it possible for the first time for human beings to actually produce a surplus of food. And with a surplus of food, the population began to grow. And so we actually see the expanding human population coincided with the onset of climate stability 9,000 years ago. And as long as that has been sustained, the population's been growing. And when that cycle, or when that climate stability ends, the human population will dramatically decline if we're still here.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. Here's how this drawing's gonna work. We have three books that we are going to draw for. His second most recent book is Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And his most recent book, Improbable Planet, which we have two copies of. So I'm going to, Dr. Ross is going to draw a name. Whoever comes up first gets